Welcome to Yes Indeed Pod, a podcast about indie tabletop role-playing games where I interview creators about their games and inspirations and about the theory, process and practice of game design. My name is Mark Shepherd, your host today and always, and your friendly local indie enthusiast. This is my final October at Yes Indeed Pod, and to draw me out of my shell a little, I wanted to try a very spooky horror gaming double feature. Here's the first episode, an interview with Thomas Elliott of Sixpence Games about Fear of the Unknown, a one-shot mystery-solving horror game with heavy influences from slasher films. This game sounds amazing, so if you like the sound of it, you've got until Monday at midnight to back it on Kickstarter. Now that's out of my head and into yours, let's talk indie. So today we're talking to Thomas Elliott of Sixpence Games. Hi there, Thomas, and welcome to the podcast.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Absolutely no problem. I've been sort of half following your stuff for a little while now, and it's nice to have you on the podcast, yeah. Especially in this particularly spooky month. Now, Thomas, would you like to take a minute to introduce yourself and let us know what you do in indie tabletop role-playing games?
Yeah, I'm Thomas Elliott. I've been making games since 2012. I started in board and card games and then moved to role-playing games a little while back. I've published one role-playing game and am currently kickstarting my second one. My first one is called Murder Most Foul, and it is an infinitely replayable murder mystery dinner party game where the players commit and solve the murder during the game.
Nice.
Oh, thank you. My second one, the one that's on Kickstarter right now, is called Fear of the Unknown. It is a zero-prep horror mystery role-playing game where every game is a horror film.
Nice.
Solve mysteries, face perils, encounter horrors, and see how that changes you as a person.
You've got that elevator pitch nailed really nicely there.
Thanks, I've said it a lot.
I appreciate sharing it. Absolutely. Fans of Yes Indeed Pod, which I guess includes yourself, will know that I am not a massive horror fan. I actually really like horror films, but only if I can read the Wikipedia articles beforehand to make sure I'm not going to be too scared. And horror games are sort of, I would have to dare myself to play them. But one of the fans said to me, Mark, you should go out and get people to explain to you why horror gaming is cool. So what I would like you to do is to try and sell me on the genre of horror games in general, and specifically why you think Fear of the Unknown is the game that would crack my horror gaming egg.
That's a really interesting question. So I like horror as a genre a great deal, especially horror films. There are a few different things that appeal about it to me, and so let me know if any of these appeal to you.
Yeah.
One of them is I enjoy caring about characters and like being on the edge of my seat as to whether or not they'll succeed or make it out alive or what have you.
Yeah.
In a typical like action film, you feel pretty confident that the main characters will make it out alive, but that's not necessarily the case in a horror film. And so
yep.
I feel a much greater sense of tension.
Yeah.
One of my friends, John Carpenter, a thing that he told me about that he really gets a lot of enjoyment from horror films is that when you're stressed out about real life things, which are usually not like immediate dangers, they're usually longer term things or bigger societal level things, It can be cathartic to watch someone be in a very immediate danger. And knowing that it is a fictional danger where no matter how caught up you get in it, even if the character goes through these horrible things, you know that the actor is fine. And so for an hour and a half, you can forget about real world stresses and let your body get all of those stress chemicals out. And when it's done, feel more relaxed.
I mean, as a counterpoint, do you ever watch horror films and then find yourself thinking about them at sort of midnight? Stopping you from sleeping.
I have, though it's been a while since a traditional horror film has done that for me.
Mm-hmm.
Mostly because I've just watched such an incredibly large number of them.
You become immune to it. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Although I've also watched a fair number of less traditional horror films, and some of those still do disturb me in that way.
Do you have a favorite horror genre?
Slasher films.
What's your favorite slasher film then? What's the archetype of slasher films for you? Maybe that's not the same thing as your favorite.
Those are not the same thing. So my favorite slasher film, and the one that I would say is, if you want to watch one slasher film in order to get an understanding of the kinds of stories that Fear of the Unknown tries to tell, I would recommend the 1981 Canadian film My Bloody Valentine.
Nice. Yes, I have at least heard of it.
I really like it because it has interesting characters who have interesting dynamics. Like there's a love triangle at the center of the film, and the setting, the town of Valentine, is really well established. There's really distinct locations that the characters move between, which is something that I really tried to do in Fear of the Unknown as well. The players collaboratively create the small town setting at the beginning of the session.
Yeah.
And it's a mystery. I would say most slasher films are mystery films, but there are also ones where it's just extremely straightforward.
Mm.
But this one is not only is it a mystery, it's a mystery that you actually can sort of unravel as you're watching it if you pay close attention. That's my favorite slasher film.
Right.
As far as the archetypal slasher film, probably Halloween.
Okay, yeah, that's fair.
It certainly inspired a great deal. It's not the first one. It's not the best one, in my opinion, although it is quite good. But it is the one that I think created the most inspiration in filmmakers who followed it.
That's really interesting. Thanks for taking us through that. It's not my favorite. I sort of prefer supernatural horror films if I'm going to watch them. And they do. They just give me the heebie-jeebies. So that's how it goes. You've told me your favorite is one that inspired Fear of the Unknown. What is it about horror films that led you to think, oh, do you know what? That's going to make for a cool game.
I already really like horror gaming. And in fact, asking about the games that inspired Fear of the Unknown and the movies that inspired Fear of the Unknown, if anyone is interested in getting this in even more detail, I do have a ludography and a videography in the full book.
What's in the ludography? Because I think it's always interesting to look at the genealogy of games.
Sure, I can read you what I wrote. Call of Cthulhu introduced me to horror and investigation and role-playing games.
Yeah.
This got me started thinking about what could be done in this space and what I want out of mechanics to support this kind of story. Apocalypse World and PBTA in general taught me about having a story-first game with mechanics that don't try to simulate a world, but instead affect the narrative.
Yeah.
City of Mist taught me about building characters out of descriptive phrases and specific unique character traits instead of using numerical variants of the same statistics for everyone.
Yeah.
Gumshoe and its hacks, which actually the first Gumshoe game that I encountered was Bubble Gumshoe, so that was actually the first one I read.
That's quite different. That's a sort of different vibe to what you're going for here, I guess.
Kind
of, okay.
you can play a lighter-hearted game of Fear of the Unknown, but it is intended for a bit more mature stories. Gumshoe and its hacks taught me about how to make investigation fun and rewarding and avoid frustration and be guaranteed to move the story forward.
Yeah.
Turn of the Card taught me about how enjoyable it is to have mechanics that give specific yet open-ended prompts for the players to improvise on, finding a fun balance between entirely promptless and overly restrictive.
It's not one I've heard of. Do you know who the author of that is?
Turn of the Card, created by Paul Abeta and Jefferson Lee. Instead of rolling dice or what have you, you have a hand of tarot cards. The core mechanic sort of has two parts, one of which I find not super duper interesting, but the other one of which I absolutely love. A thing will have a difficulty challenge that you need to beat in order to succeed at whatever the task is. And so you can either like play a numbered card out of your hand that plus your skill is high enough to beat the DC. Or if you have major arcana cards in your hand, like the Hierophant and the Devil and the Tower, etc., you can play one of those to succeed at whatever check it is you're trying to do, but you have to describe how the way in which you succeed has to be related to the card that you play.
That does sound really cool, actually. Yeah.
Yeah, it was great fun. I remember a scene where I had a character who was an environmental activist who was having like a battle of wits with this like Nestle executive, and I played the devil card because I'm like, yeah, my character thinks that this guy is the devil, and so I managed to outwit him. And
nice.
It was very fun.
That's very cool. Yeah. Was there anything else in your ludography? Or
there's one more. It's Dread.
Yeah.
Dread taught me about creating tension and fear by moving inexorably closer to death, while always leaving open the possibility of success if you are good and lucky enough.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I sort of spoke to Alex Roberts about Dread and rather related back to that about Starcrossed as well. And I think that very, very physical tension building element is fascinating and something I would love even more as a design tool if I were in any way competent at tumbling block tag games.
It is interesting putting in that element of player skill, not just in terms of like decisions, but physical dexterity.
That's what puts me off. So yeah, we've talked about a handful of games there, but we haven't yet talked about yours. So why don't you tell us a little bit about Fear of the Unknown and like what the mechanics of it are that lend it really well to playing tension-filled horror games?
So Fear of the Unknown is powered by the apocalypse. And like I mentioned with the City of Mists inspiration, it doesn't have ability scores with, you know, numbers. There's no such thing as having like plus three strength or luck or what have you. Instead, every character has positive, negative, and wild tags, which are short descriptive phrases. For positive tags, for instance, they define your skills and abilities, possessions, relationships with other characters, things like that. And for negative tags, they are things that get in your way or like hamper you when you're trying to do things. So, which actually brings me to something that you were mentioning earlier about how when you're watching a horror movie, you want to read the Wikipedia article first to make sure that it doesn't have elements in it that will be really upsetting. And that's something that I wanted to take into account in this, because I know that there are some things that some players will really want to have be an element of their game, and other players will really not want to have that. And so something that I've seen in a lot of existing horror games that I've talked with people who have been really upset by it is mechanics where like suddenly, not necessarily without warning, but without your ability to control it, your character is now paralyzed and in a wheelchair or something like that.
Yeah.
And so I thought for a while about whether to include that sort of mechanic in Fear of the Unknown. And what the conclusion that I came to is that the mechanics, which are entirely player-facing, the GM doesn't roll dice, the mechanics will tell you when your character gains a negative tag, but the player will always decide what it is.
Yeah.
Like your character will get injured, but you decide what the injury is. Or your character, you know, is experiencing trauma and you decide what the trauma symptom is. And it's not just like picking from a list. It's more open and ended. And while there are suggestions, you don't have to pick one of the suggestions.
Yeah.
And this also allows for people who want to explore social aspects of their characters in the game to do so, or who want to have a character who has a social aspect to them that might cause problems in real life because of the way other people treat them, but they want that to be an aspect of their character that is true of their character, but doesn't, you know, come up in the narrative as a thing causing problems for them. You can go either way.
Yeah. It's really nice to give your players the agency to control their own character destinies in that, on that front. And it's a really important aspect of table safety, which is definitely something that would immediately spring to mind when I was, you know, taking on a horror game or something. Are there any other safety tools that you explicitly introduce, or is it left a little bit to GM and player judgment?
I briefly talk in the book about lines and veils and the X card, which I'm guessing your listeners are already familiar with. But in practice, I've found that the sort of built-in tools here of what I was just describing about how the player is always the one who picks what negative tags are affecting them and picks whether or not their different aspects of their identity are represented mechanically by tags, I've found that to actually be pretty robust and done quite a good job of preventing that sort of mishap, at least so far.
Yeah. Have you had any table mishaps at all, or has it been fairly straightforward?
Nothing that's like about the sort of subject we're talking about right now. I've had played with like a Grognard who just doesn't really understand this whole fiction first idea and just sort of got annoyed by it. I played in a game at a convention with actually like two of the players were a father and son, and the father was only at the convention because he was there to like be supportive of his son.
Yeah.
The son was great. He was this, you know, he had a cool character. He was this great role player. Mm. And the father made a joke character that some people would have considered slightly offensive. I mean, it was a full table, so I basically just sort of focused more on the other characters a bit.
Fair. Which is probably what they would have expected, right? So it's good that there's no, that you haven't had that sort of experience of people being upset by what they're playing, you know. It's the putting people in control is definitely the kind of thing that I would want to see. So
yeah,
that's really clever design, and that's a reason why PBTA is good, because it puts the players in control of their own destinies a lot more than, I don't know, let's say something more traditional like 5th edition.
Yeah.
That's very driven by what the GM thinks, and therefore is very not focused on what might be upsetting to the players. So yeah, I'm into that. I mean, there may at some point, I guess, be some kind of player-to-player conflict on what people think is acceptable. But again, that's why you have Lines and Veils. And a good discussion in Session Zero, I guess.
Interesting point about Session Zero is that Fear of the Unknown is designed primarily for one-shots.
Right.
And also a lot of the development of your character and the setting and stuff, although a bunch of it is front-loaded, a lot of it does occur during play.
Mm.
And so, for instance, on the Encounter True Horror move, which is the move that you do when you're in a horrifying situation, one of the options where you gain a trauma symptom, the text of the rules specifically say that you should pick one that you are interested in exploring and that everyone on the table is comfortable with having be part of the game.
So it's still kind of that you have to be careful and aware of what other people think is okay to play with.
Yeah. I've played other games where like there was explicit discussion of Lines and Veils at the beginning and there was an X card in play. I didn't run this was a different system at a convention, but I spoke with one of the players afterwards and they told me that they had just like forgotten to bring something up that they would have had covered by Lines and Veils if they had remembered to, and then they felt too awkward to use the X card during play. And so one of the things that I try to emphasize in the text of the rules is that it's an ongoing conversation.
Mm.
I've found, certainly I'm not saying that this is the norm or anything, but I have found that occasionally when people establish boundaries during the initial discussion before a game, there are some players who then sort of use that as though it were a set of rules as written that they can rules lawyer with.
Yes, that is a thing that I think a lot of people have experience of. And I think particularly for people who do have very strong Lines and Veils. Like for me, I have a set of things that I will tell people at the start of a game that if I see them, I'm just going to walk away from the game. And I have used that in the past in a game of Bluebeard's Bride, just like a story I've talked about before. Like some people have like very obvious ones like, oh, I don't want spiders or eyeballs in the game. And some people are like, yeah, that's fine. But other people have things that are more difficult to raise at the start of a game, and you might not want to talk about them for whatever reason, but also B, you know, it is that kind of spectrum of things that maybe half of it is okay and half of it is not okay. And that's why a really good conversation and a lot of trust between people is important. And I think for an established game group, you probably know your players well enough. And I think it can be quite difficult at a convention, which I guess is something you've sort of hinted at there.
Yeah. Although I have not really been playing Fear of the Unknown with a single established group.
Mm.
I have a Discord where I organize games, and there certainly are players who show up in games more often than others, but
yeah,
it's actually quite rare for me to run two games with the exact same set of players.
And you've still managed to maintain that kind of, oh, everybody leaves the game feeling okay. Well, hopefully.
Yeah, certainly. I check in with my players at the end of the game, you know, in addition to continually checking in throughout the game.
Yeah.
And nobody has complained about that to me. If anyone has complained about it elsewhere, yeah, I'm unaware of that, but I know.
Yeah, and that's really good. I think what you're talking about there is kind of a best practice, isn't it? Like, talk about it before, talk about it during, and talk about it afterwards, and make sure that everybody is happy.
Yeah.
And I think there's a big tradition of that in, like, LARP, where physical safety and emotional safety is really important. And we're kind of getting to the stage where that's acceptable and normal in most indie tabletop role-playing games now. Maybe not further afield, but I guess that's a question for another time.
Yeah.
We've talked about how to make sure that you have a good game and a fun game and a safe game. What is it about PBTA that makes for a good tension mechanic, for instance, which I think is really important in a horror game?
I started talking about the mechanics of Fear of the Unknown, and then we got sort of sidetracked on this.
We got massively sidetracked
on this discussion of safety mechanics. There are three basic moves in Fear of the Unknown: investigate, face peril, and encounter true horror. Investigate and face peril use the tags that we were talking about earlier, which are these fictional elements within the setting and the narrative that describe the characters and the setting that you establish at the beginning of the game when you create the setting together, and then everybody creates their characters together.
Yeah.
And the investigate move you use to sort of construct scenes out of these different narrative elements where your characters learn something. And the face peril move, you also use those narrative elements whenever your characters are in a potentially deadly situation. And the thing that I did to create tension there is there's no such thing as hit points or anything like that in Fear of the Unknown. Instead, the moves have sort of traditional PBTA structure of roll 2d6, add, in this case, the number of positive tags that the player invoked up to 3, subtract the number of negative tags that the GM invoked up to 2, and then see which results range you lie in.
Yeah.
And so for investigate and face peril, that's 10 plus or 7 through 9 or 6 or below. And minor aside, whenever the GM invokes one of your negative tags, you gain a humanity, which is one of the 3 kinds of experience. And I'm very happy with the naming there, because having character flaws and having difficulties that you need to overcome makes your character more human.
Absolutely, yeah.
What I did with the face peril move to make it, like you said, ratcheting up that tension, is that on both of these moves, and also on Encounter True Horror, whichever results range you land in, there's different options that you pick. And some of those options have a dot next to them, which means that you can pick them anytime that you land in that range. And other options have a circle next to them, which you need to mark off when you pick them, and then you cannot pick that option again unless you recover it in some way.
So you've got a sort of resource in your move responses.
Yes.
Which, that's always good for tension, yeah.
Yeah. And so for all of the results ranges, for all the different moves, there are like at least 2 circle options and then a dot option, which introduces some sort of complication, but lets you recover the circle options. Except on the 7 through 9 results on face peril, on those, each of the circle options is like a different type of injury that you can get, where it's typically gaining a negative tag, which again, the player, they decide what that specific negative tag will be. But then the last option is that your character dies. And because there's no way to recover these in this move, every time you mark one off, you're getting one step closer to dying.
To just having to check off my character dies. Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah.
This was the system that I was running with for a long time. And then one of the later changes to this that happened during playtesting, when one that I'm very proud of, in addition to the tags that your character has, the setting has 5 tags that describe locations and characters, NPCs, and things like that, which any player can invoke these, and also the GM can invoke these.
Yeah.
One of the options, which has a dot next to it, so you can pick it anytime you roll a 7 through 9 on face peril, one of the town tags that was invoked on that roll gets marked off and destroyed in some way.
Right, yeah.
One of the things that I find is very important for horror films and horror stories in general is that the viewers or what have you have strong opinions about the characters and the setting. And these can be strong positive or negative opinions. And because the players are the ones who created the setting, marking off one of these tags, like destroying something in town, either like an NPC dying or a location getting burned down or flooded or something like that,
yeah,
is emotionally impactful for them. And because this is a decision that they have to make, I've seen situations where players will go, oh man, I really don't want my character to, get seriously injured in this moment. I guess I'm going to have to destroy
something in town instead.
The diner or what have you. Or like I've seen players
That's
decide
cool.
to have their character get really injured in order to yeah. save this NPC that was in the
Oh,
scene.
That makes a really interesting choice, choosing the least bad option. That's mean. And I guess that still gives the player some control. Do they also pick what is destroyed, or is that...
So the way that it works is when you need to face peril, the player picks up to three positive or wild tags that they would like to invoke. And all of the town tags are wild tags. So they can pick, say, like two of their own and one town tag, or two town tags and one of their own, or three town tags if that makes sense in the fiction. And then the GM picks up to two of that player's negative or wild tags or town tags that they think would get in the player's way in some fashion.
Yeah.
And so after the roll and the player is making the decision as to whether to mark off one of the town tags, they can only mark off a tag that was invoked on that roll, but they can mark off a tag that they invoked or a tag that the GM invoked.
Okay, I
see. So they know what the options are that they're choosing from.
That's still giving you that kind of player agency over what the bad thing that happens is. But at the same time, you know, if you're invoking something, then in general, it's going to be something that you're attached to, presumably.
Yeah, yeah. So.
That's really cool. I like that a lot. Yeah. A big part of what you're talking about earlier with slasher films, which I guess is something that you're really into, is the investigation part of it. So what the investigation mechanics like in Fear of the Unknown?
Before I talk about the investigate move a little, I'll talk about the GM tools.
Yeah.
So the idea with this is it is a zero prep mystery game where there is actually like a secret for the players to uncover. And so,
I mean, all of those things are like quite hard to balance, aren't they? One shot, zero prep, but also a mystery. That's tough. Yeah.
Which is what makes me so happy that I feel I've succeeded at it.
Yeah, fantastic.
I've been running zero prep games of this for a good number of months now. And yeah. Getting other people to run it as well. And my favorite is when people give me positive feedback and that they are surprised that they are giving me this positive feedback, which is very gratifying. There are a number of random tables that the GM can roll on to get the skeleton of a mystery.
Yeah.
So for instance, I've got this D6, and if the 4D6 tables, the first one is the source, which is like what kind of thing or person is the antagonist. The second one is what is their motive, like revenge or obsession or jealousy, etc.
Mm-hmm.
The third one is what are they doing, so like seemingly random killings or kidnapping people, etc. And then the fourth one is the inciting incident, which is how the protagonists learn that there is a secret to uncover.
That's really important for a one-shot, isn't it, to kind of get everybody on board en media res. You know, that's a cool little mechanic. I like that.
The general structure of how I run a game of this is I roll a d6 four times at the beginning to give me that skeleton, and then we create the setting together, and then the players create their characters together. And while that's going on, I'm listening to what they're doing and thinking about how it might relate to the skeleton that I've created, and using specific details from what they come up with to put the flesh on the bones and get a fully formed mystery by the time that we're ready to begin playing.
That reminds me of what Duane Figueroa Sol does with Noctis Labyrinth. While the players are deciding what they're interested in, the GM is listening and thinking, well, where am I going to take this adventure then? You know, how am I going to spin that, and what are we going to investigate? So yeah, that's really cool. It's a nice way of getting on with things. Gives you some time to prepare when you have zero prep. That's cool.
I've sometimes been calling this a fiction first game, which is only kind of true. I think it's more precise to call it a narrativist game, because in fiction first Powered by the Apocalypse games, the typical structure of it is that you explain what your character is doing, and if your description of that happens to contain the name of a move, then that's a cue that you should activate that move and see how the mechanics affect the narrative. Fear of the Unknown is so focused on horrifying mysteries. The vast bulk of what the players are doing, what the protagonists are doing, is either investigating or they're in some sort of trouble, which is where the face peril and encounter true horror moves come into play.
Yeah.
And so what I wanted to do with the investigate move, and especially with making this be zero prep, is that the GM does not come up with clues ahead of time. Instead, when the players have a question that they want to either find the answer to or get a clue as to the answer to, you use the investigate move and the question that they're asking to construct a scene where they can try to find that information.
Right.
And whether they succeed or not is typically they should always find some amount of information. It's just a question of what other things also happen in the scene.
Yeah.
An example, if we have two different protagonists who are both wondering the same question, which is, we've stumbled upon this dead body. They look like they've been poisoned. I would like to find out what the source of that poison might be. And we have one of the characters saying, okay, well, my character has mafia connections and an intimidating physique. So I want to use those two tags to try to answer the question, where might this poison have come from? Then you can see how that would construct a scene that's something like them, you know, going around and talking to mob members. And yeah, if they're not willing to talk, oh, they, you know, they scare them into talking. And another character who's trying to answer the same question might do things like, okay, I'll use my gardening club tag and my friends who work at the university to see if any of them might be familiar with
yeah,
a plant or something that has this. And so you see how, like, learning the same sort of information with two different characters can result in two very different scenes that mechanically play out the same way.
That's a really interesting scene framing device. Yeah. So obvious, but something that I think sort of happens within scene in other games. And by front loading it into the question of the scene itself is a really interesting way of doing it. And it, you're right, it is that kind of Forge era scene framing device, which feels less like fiction first role playing and more like that kind of narrativist role playing. Like, no shade on that, because that's really cool. It's definitely the kind of thing that I'm into. I love scene framing devices.
Thank you. Me too. It's something that I didn't really set out with this in mind when I started designing, but sort of just kept coming up.
Yeah, it's really cool.
If I let people use the mechanics to determine the outcome of the scene before they play it out, it really generates this sort of feeling of freedom for the players to be able to play it out the way that they want, knowing that the sort of mechanical outcome of the scene has already been determined.
Yeah.
I was really worried it would be the other way, that it would feel overly restrictive, but people have told me more than once, especially with the revelations, which I haven't gotten to, that it gives them a feeling of freedom in being able to control the narrative aspects of things. The revelations are the three moves that you use when you spend the three different forms of experience. So whenever your negative tags are invoked, you gain humanity, which you can then use to reveal something about yourself. And whenever you encounter true horror, you gain horror. Unlike an investigate and face peril, where rolling higher is better, on encounter true horror, you roll 2d6 and you add the amount of horror you've accumulated so far, and rolling higher is more dangerous.
It's bad. Yes. Okay. Oh, another good tension mechanic.
Yeah. Thank you. And if you're worried about accumulating too much horror, if you have three or more of it, you can make the revelation, let the horror sink in, where you get rid of three horror, but you have to make some decision as to what bad thing happens. And then finally, every time that you roll a six or below on any of the moves, you gain a foreboding.
Yeah.
You can spend three foreboding to reveal something about the world and change the story or setting in some way outside of your character.
Okay, yeah.
You don't roll any dice to do them. You just spend the appropriate resource and then you pick the mechanical result. And then the player has total narrative control over what the scene is. I was originally envisioning these as downtime moves, but at the feedback of one of the playtesters, I changed them to, the default for them now is that they're flashback.
That's interesting, yeah.
Sort of a Blades in the Dark kind of feel there. Where
that's kind of a cool horror trope as well, where you look back and realize something.
Yes, something that I'm very happy with this is how much setup and payoff naturally occurs in this, because people pick all of these tags at the beginning when they're creating the setting and their characters, and then a very common thing to happen is that a player will have like one or two positive tags for their character that are their main things, and those ones come up on almost every roll, and then they'll have other tags that may almost never come up. And so, for instance, I ran a game recently where one of the players picked stamp collecting as one of their positive tags.
Right.
And she was asking me, you know, like, is that appropriate? I'm like, well, can you think of a way that that might come up during play? If so, then yes, it's appropriate. And she's like, okay, I bet I can come up with something by the end. And then in the climactic battle against the invisible antagonist, she said, like, okay, we're traveling. I have my stamp collection with me. I want to invoke that tag on this face peril roll, and I want to have it be that the antagonist, like, knocks over my stamp collection and gets a bunch of stamps stuck to them.
So then you can see where you are.
Yeah.
That's really cool.
Which I thought was just incredibly creative.
I love it.
Would not have thought of ahead of time. And so
that's so cool.
The setup and payoff there of, like, we know this character collects stamps. How will that be relevant? And eventually it was. So satisfying.
So you've got a series of revelations. Does that kind of framing eventually lead you round to the final showdown? Or are there other GM tools sitting in the background that get you there?
So because there aren't things like clocks or hit points, aside from the face peril bit that we were talking about earlier, there is no strict mechanic forcing the showdown to occur at a specific time.
Right.
Instead, there's guidelines in the GM section of the rulebook telling you, like, basically what determines when there is a showdown is one of two things. Either the players solve the mystery and come up with a way to force there to be a showdown, or you decide to have the antagonist directly confront the protagonists, and that causes there to be a showdown. And when possible, you should probably go for the first of those two options.
Yeah.
If you want to control how long the game is, because it's intended to be a one-shot, but a one-shot could be 5 hours, a one-shot could be 2 hours. And so the big difference there is how much information do you give the players each time that they investigate?
Yeah.
I ran a game where a player halfway through, like, we spent an hour on character creation, and then a player revealed that they only had an hour left that they could play. And so I think there was like two investigations and then the showdown. And I've had a game that lasted like 5.5 hours and was much more involved.
The longer burn, Call of Cthulhu style investigation. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's interesting that you are controlling that pacing on the fly, and that works through the, you know, the ratchets of tension that we've discussed there. So, you know, we've got through a lot of material, and
yeah,
I'm sort of running out of time, but there's so many stuff we haven't talked about. Like, we haven't even mentioned, you know, building a town, building characters or so on. Do you want to just really, really quickly take us through what the world building elements of this are? Because I love world building.
Absolutely. Building the setting, the way it works is the GM asks the players the general location and time period that this is set. It's an isolated small town somewhere, most often in the 20th or 21st centuries, but not necessarily. And then once you establish that, you generate the 5 town tags.
Yeah.
And the way you do that is that the GM asks the players, so the first question is, what is a local landmark? Gain a town tag like the abandoned quarry, or the statue of the beloved town founder, or the only diner in town.
Right.
Second question is, who is someone that everyone in town knows, or at least knows of? Gain a town tag like the gregarious dean, or the slimy mayor, or the quietly intimidating crime lord.
These aren't leading at all.
No. The third question is, what is a group that at least a sizable portion of the town despises? Gain a town tag like the corrupt police, or the Ivory Tower University, or the biker gang with hearts of gold. The fourth question is, what is something that the town is obsessed with? Gain a town tag like the crosstown sports rivalry, or the annual harvest festival, or the stories of cryptids in the woods. And then the fifth question is, pick one of those four questions and ask it again. So you might have 2 landmarks or 2 prominent NPCs, etc. Ah,
that's really cool. Yeah, that's a really nice way of building a town. It reminds me a little bit of world building games like Beak Feather and Bone and things like that. And I'm really into that. And I really love collaborative world building at the start of games, be they one shots or campaigns. So
I'd say the most direct inspiration for it was Kids on Bikes.
As somebody who is very, very late to the Stranger Things party, I'm like sort of seeing a whole genre of RPGs in a new light now.
Yeah.
So Fear of the Unknown is currently on Kickstarter for the remainder of the month. Do you want to very, very, very quickly tell us a little bit about your Kickstarter campaign.
It's relatively straightforward. There aren't a whole lot of bells and whistles on it. You can get the book, you can get a PDF, you can get these slash dice made by Black Oak Workshop. You could get the GM screen, which has tools that are also in the book, but easy to reference it if it's on a screen. And you can get these little Acolyte of the Nameless Cult enamel pins.
Oh, cool. Love me an enamel pin.
In terms of stretch goals, since we've already met the primary goal, only one of them is about how much money we raise. You can also reach a stretch goal by sharing it enough times on social media, by there being enough individual backers, and by people besides me running games of it during October.
Well, that sounds really, really cool. Yeah.
Thank you. You can download the Quick Start Rules, which has almost all of the player-facing rules in them, but does not have the GM tools. You need the full copy of that in order to get those random tables I was talking about earlier to generate the skeleton of the mystery, as well as some other useful random tables, such as my personal favorite, Why Won't the Police Help?
You know, depending on your personal political affiliation, you might already have an answer to that, but, you know, let's not.
Oh, yes. I suspect you'll get a kick out of reading the different possibilities there.
Oh, I do like that. That amuses me greatly. Fantastic. Well, and that's running until the end of October, I think we said earlier.
Yep, midnight on Halloween.
Absolute perfect timing then. So yeah, you'll probably have a couple of weeks to back this by the time this episode comes out, depending on whether I can get my act together or not. So there, thank you very much. Open. That's great. So thank you, Thomas, for taking us through all of that. And would you like to tell us where we can find you on the internet?
I'm on Twitter at Sixpence Games, although I am probably going to use it a good deal less just for my own mental health once the campaign is over.
Yes, please.
Yeah, you can find the links to the Kickstarter and the Discord and such at fearoftheunknownrpg.com. I organize games regularly on the Discord, and I also have a podcast where I interview people and post actual plays of Fear of the Unknown. It's called Invasion of the Pod People, and it's on Spotify. The people that I interview are not game designers, but are instead independent horror filmmakers.
Fantastic. Everybody should go and check that out, because you know, I do love podcasts. Well, please, please, please go and check out all of those things. And if you really like the sound of Fear of the Unknown, like myself, I think that's sort of sold me on horror games to some extent, then go and check it out before the end of the month. And if you're listening in, you know, whatever, 18 months time, then go and buy it instead, because I'm sure it'll be available by
then. Yeah, I'll definitely have the Kickstarter page have a link to wherever you can get it when you can get it.
Fantastic. And I guess all that remains for me to say is thank you very much for coming on Yes Indeed Pod, and fantastically good luck with your Kickstarter campaign.
Thank you so much for having me. This was great fun.
Thanks for listening, and thanks again to Thomas for the interview. As always, you can find all of the links in the episode description. The next part of our Horror Double Feature will be an interview with James Davey about the incredible The Midnight World, a game that spans the full gamut of personal and cosmic horror through clever mechanics and fascinating explorations of mental health. This interview was great, so please check it out right after this one. This episode is kindly sponsored by Kurt Reffling and Ian Howard, whose game Here We Used to Fly is on Kickstarter now. Here We Used to Fly is a GM-less game about abandoned theme parks and the bittersweet nostalgia of growing up. Inspired by narrative games like Wonder Home and Fall of Magic, Here We Used to Fly tells stories of people and how they change. Become a kid at a theme park, and the adult they grow into exploring its ruins. Flash back and forth in time to see how your characters and their relationships change. Create a place that never existed and then mourn its loss. Here We Used to Fly is on Kickstarter until November 15th, 2022. It's your turn to ride. This week, I'd like to thank some of my incredible Patreon supporters. Hesan Yongdi, Sam Armstrong, Beyond Cataclysm Games, Georgie Batts, Sam Lee, Jack Blair, Peter Ike, and our newest patron, Tentacle Duck. Thank you all so, so much. We couldn't do what we do without you. And you, yes you, can get a regular shout out and joyful thanks too if you go to patreon.com/yesindeedpod and sign up today. You'll get access to our Discord server where we can hang out and chat, and even join monthly editing streams and the Yes Indeed Pod book club. Most of the money will go directly to creators rather than to me, so you'll be investing directly in the indie scene, helping to make it a healthy and inclusive place for years to come. And if you can't commit regularly, you can always help out by rating and reviewing the show wherever you find your podcasts, or by donating through the Ko-Fi page at ko-fi.com/yesindeedpod. Of course, you can always reach out to me through Twitter at yesindeedpod. That's YESINDIEDPOD. I'd love dearly to hear from you. Lastly, music credits. All music is taken from Be Quiet by Yatzar, from the Free Music Archive, released under Creative Commons Attribution Sharealike 3.0 International License. Thanks, Yatzar! And until next time, remember, does indie need you? Yes, indeed.